This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Last Saturday afternoon in Foxborough, Massachusetts, Ante Jezic, Kyle Martino, and various other members of the Los Angeles Galaxy were thumping the soccer ball around, preparing for the next day's game against the New England Revolution. Enter David Beckham. Cue the photographer. Not since Pele came to the U.S. 32 years ago to glitter in the North American Soccer League has an individual player caused such a fuss in the land where soccer has been the batty old ant at the sports table, struggling for the scraps left by football, basketball, and baseball. But there are some significant distinctions between Pele and Beckham. Pele was never half of a celebrity couple, and when he came to New York, Pele played. When David Beckham arrived in New England, he had been on the field for just 20 minutes of MLS competition, though he'd previously indicated that he hoped he would play as much as half of Sunday's game against the Revolution. After Saturday's practice, he was hedging.
I'm not sure at this present moment. I hope I can play some minutes, but I'm not 100% sure that I will, so we'll just have to wait and see what happens tomorrow.
Having planted that cannonball-sized seed of doubt, David Beckham felt compelled to explain that if he couldn't play, he'd be at least as disappointed as the people, roughly 35,000 of them, who'd bought tickets for his only regular season New England appearance.
I want to play in the game. It's what I do. It's what I love doing. But if I don't play, it's for a good reason. It's not just because I'm being soft.
The good reason to which Mr. Beckham referred is his balky left ankle, which he injured playing for England in early June. Rather than rest the ankle, he numbed it with injections and played his two final games for Real Madrid, wins Madrid needed to finish on top of La Liga. When he arrived in Los Angeles on July 13th to join the Galaxy, Beckham was damaged goods. He sat out five of his new team's first six games, and playing 20 minutes in a losing effort against DC United a week ago Thursday proved to be a setback rather than a tune-up. Still, on Sunday afternoon, the parking lot next to Gillette Stadium was full of people hoping, for various reasons, that David Beckham would play.
He's a good player. He's got quick feet. He passes well. He's pretty.
Oh, no, finally. We finally got the pretty. All right, that's good.
I'm jumping on the bandwagon because I think he's pretty cute, so that's about my interest in him.
Lisa and Jessica, two of the many women contending that David Beckham's charms are not limited to his ability to bend a soccer ball past a diving goalkeeper or drop it onto the foot of a teammate on the run half a field away, had some younger company behind a nearby minivan. I asked a dozen or so girls from South Weymouth, Massachusetts, how many of them had come to the game because David Beckham was there.
How do you suppose poor Andy Dorman's going to feel about that on the Revolution when you're all here to see Beckham?
He just has to be hotter, I guess.
Dorman, a midfielder with the home team, is, like Beckham, an Englishman. But while Dorman's four-year contract is worth perhaps $100,000, Beckham's deal and the endorsements it has made possible may earn him over $200 million. While Beckham and his wife, who answers to Posh, live in a mansion next to Tom Cruise and Kate Holmes in L.A., Dorman rents a room in a Boston suburb 25 miles north of where the Revs play. Still, being David Beckham is not always as much fun as it might seem to be, at least according to the man who should know.
Of course, there's the odd day where you wish that you could have some privacy. You know, those parts of the days are when I'm with my children. I've always said that this that surrounds me and my family and my wife is part of our lives. You know, we accept it, but the only time when I would like a bit of privacy is when I'm with the kids and when I want to take the kids, I don't know, to the beach or to the park. That's the only time when I would like it.
Any other player confined to the bench, which is where David Beckham spent all of Sunday night's game, might have safely assumed his privacy wouldn't be threatened. But since many of the 35,000 people in the building had come to see him play, and since most of them had no idea that the decision to hold him out of the game had been made well before they turned up for the match, the evening was punctuated with chants urging him to run out onto the field. And And when David Beckham, dressed in warm-ups rather than a uniform, appeared on the message board in the closing minutes of the game, and it became clear even to the most fervent dreamers that he would not play, the response was nearly unanimous. Though some of those in attendance might not have noticed, the Revolution won Sunday night's game 1-0 on a particularly dexterous Taylor Twellman goal. And if the frustration in the stands at David Beckham's absence from the game was considerable, it was nothing compared to that felt by Galaxy coach Frank Yallop, who was asked after the match whether the presence of a healthy Beckham would have made a difference that night.
I don't know. I haven't seen him play for us yet. I think we're missing a good player. I mean, obviously. I think that... you know, he's going to make a difference to our team, and he did in the 20 minutes he played against DC. That he did, but you know, again, he hasn't trained with us. He's not really been integrated with the team yet, and we're sort of getting to vital games. You know, we're excited to have him, you know, with us. We just want to get him on the field. Every time I see him play, he makes some big difference to the match, and I think that we're missing that.
The missing was not to go on any longer. David Beckham not only played in Wednesday night's Superliga game against DC United, he scored a Bendit-like Beckhamish goal on a free kick and assisted on the Landon Donovan goal that iced the 2-0 win for the Galaxy. Beckham is also expected to play tonight when the Galaxy will meet the Red Bulls in front of over 50,000 Beckham watchers at Giant Stadium in New Jersey. Joining me now to remind us that Major League Soccer employs about 350 players who aren't David Beckham is Grant Wall, who writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated and SportsIllustrated.com. Grant, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be back on, Bill.
Let's talk about some of the other imports who, though less celebrated than David Beckham, have had a good deal more impact on the field. Guillermo Barros Scalotto, late of the celebrated Argentine club Boca Juniors, has been playing with a Columbus Crew. To what effect?
Well, it's a great effect lately. He's really turned around a team that has been struggling the last couple of years. And Scalotto is a hero down in Argentina, where he's been a star with Boca Juniors for a long time. People couldn't figure out why he would want to go to Columbus, Ohio and leave all of his fans behind, but he wanted to go on an adventure like David Beckham did, and I think he has an interest in maybe coaching someday, wanted to experience living in the U.S., and is really playing well, leading that team, scoring some goals on his own.
What about the illustrious and much-admired Cuauhtémoc Blanco? He's been a star in Mexico for years. Has he shown that he's got enough left to help the Chicago Fire contend?
Well, I think he really does. Even though he's 33, he's still got a lot of fire in his game. He's played well for Club America, the team that he had spent the past few years with in Mexico. He's played well for the Mexican national team of late. And he's a real fan favorite to a lot of Mexicans because he's so fiery. He's looked at as an arch villain by opposing teams, and he embraces that role. He told me a couple of weeks ago when I spoke to him that I love it. You know, I want the other fans to dislike me, and the game needs that. And I think he's right. I think he's going to be a real polarizing figure in a good way for Major League Soccer.
If you look at the Player of the Week and Player of the Month lists, you don't find the New England Revolution represented very often, but New England is 6 points clear in the Eastern Division. Only Houston and Dallas have won as many games as the Revolution. What's their secret?
Well, continuity and stability. They've really put that team together well. Steve Nichols, the coach, they've had the same big stars for a long time now, and Taylor Twellman, Pat Noonan, Steve Ralston, Matt Reese. And they just don't make many changes. They lost Clint Dempsey last year to England. He went to Fulham. But there's so much stability there, and they play really well together. There's a chemistry that comes when you play week in, week out for a number of years that you don't have if you're the Los Angeles Galaxy right now and you have a lot of talent, but they're not playing too well together.
One of the big stories as this season began was the terrific fan support evident in Toronto despite the woeful start to that team's inaugural season. The first few home games were all raucous sellouts, but after winning several mid-season games, FC Toronto has slipped back into last place in the East. Are the fans still supportive there?
They're the best fans in MLS, and I say that knowing that fans in Washington, D.C. and Chicago are great too, but I went up to a game there recently when they played Los Angeles, and the place was sold out, and it would have been sold out if David Beckham wasn't there. And that's a great sign because they get the game. They know when to cheer. They know when to boo the other team. It's a real adult crowd as opposed to some of the soccer mom crowd that you get when you go to other MLS games. And I had friends tell me, well, this is like a European atmosphere. It was actually, to me, more like a South American atmosphere with all the confetti being thrown on the field, all the crepe paper rolls being tossed at Landon Donovan when he was trying to take a corner kick. He almost couldn't move because he was just, you know, covered in crepe paper.
MLS teams are looking at the final third of their season as we speak. Grant, which teams seem most likely to finish strong and contend for the championship?
Well, I think in the East, I really like New England. I think they've got a lot of experience at playing well when it counts. I think we could see them in yet another final. Whether they'll win, who knows, because they haven't won one yet. But you look out West, and Houston is the defending champion and has played some real sustained good soccer this season. They have a lot of continuity and stability on that team like New England does. The wild card, I think, could be Los Angeles, because here's a team that has Beckham, and once he got into play earlier this week for the first time, he was great. He scored a goal. He changed the game for the Galaxy and made that much of a difference as just one player. Can the Galaxy get enough points to get into the playoffs? Because right now they are definitely on the outside looking in. If you can get into the playoffs in MLS, anyone can win. The Galaxy know better than anyone, having been the last seed 2 years ago, but went on to win the title.
Grant Wall covers soccer for Sports Illustrated and SportsIllustrated.com, and he joins me on Only a Game for some good soccer talk from time to time. Grant, thanks very much.
Good talking to you.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a mile-high humidor home for Mr. Spalding Spheroids. But first, it was barely a month ago when we laughed at New York Yankee shortstop Derek Jeter's assertion that his team could overcome the Red Sox double-digit lead in the American League East. It was also just a month ago when the defending champion St. Louis Cardinals looked cooked with a losing record in the National League Central. But hold on. Joining me now to discuss the suddenly shrinking leads in the AL East and the NL Central is Tim Kirkchian of ESPN. Tim, finally, a chance for you to say the Yankees are still the Yankees and all is right with the world.
Right. I finally got one right here, Bill. I've been asked literally 1 million times this summer, are the Yankees dead? Are the Yankees dead? And each time I kept saying, look, they're in big trouble, but they're not dead yet because they're the Yankees. And we knew coming out of the All-Star break, they had this incredible stretch against a bunch of teams with losing records. I figured they would just finally start to swing the bats like they should, and they did. And Derek Jeter, at the All-Star break, was whispering to friends, look, we're going to hit the second half, and we've got kids coming from our farm system who are going to help us in our bullpen and are going to help us in our rotation. Phil Hughes, Jabba Chamberlain, these guys have come in and really done a nice job, and now the Yankees have gotten themselves back into the playoff race. I still don't think they're going to beat the Red Sox, but if they make it as the wild card, that's a good season for the Yankees, where they, especially considering where they started out.
Well, Tim, we both know that baseball is a game where numbers mean everything, but still, literally a million times.
I misspoke on that one, Bill. Let me just say, literally, I was asked 20 times this summer. And I was 20 for 20. I said, they're not dead yet. They're the Yankees. They make the playoffs every year.
Yep.
The teams they have to beat basically are the Indians, who haven't been to the playoffs with the current team they have, and the Mariners, who haven't been to the playoffs with the current team they have. You look at that and you think, well, they have a chance to make the playoffs, and I still think they do.
The Cardinals have had a pretty rough time defending their World Series title, but they are somehow in the Central Division race. The last time we spoke, you said they had very little chance to return to the playoffs, let alone the World Series. You want to change your mind?
Bill, I didn't say very little chance. I said no chance to go back to the playoffs.
I heard it a million times.
Right. And I have a chance to be really wrong about that. Now, let's understand one thing first and foremost. The reason the Cardinals are back in it is that the Brewers and the Cubs have let them back in it. That is a fact. However, the Cardinals have shown tremendous perseverance here with all the things that have gone wrong with that team, including Chris Carpenter, their best pitcher, has made one start all year. They continue to hang in there with stories such as Rick Ankiel, the poor kid who could not throw the ball over the plate as a pitcher. So he said, all right, I got to do something else. He becomes an outfielder. He comes back to the big leagues, hits three home runs in a short amount of time. And when those things start to happen, you start to wonder, wow, is something special going on in St. Louis again?
Let's stay in the National League for just a minute. I'm willing to bet that perhaps five, perhaps six of our listeners can name more than one member of the Arizona Diamondbacks starting lineup, but they have a solid lead in the West. How many Diamondbacks can you name?
I can name them all because I have nothing else to do with my life but to understand who the backup catcher on the Diamondbacks is. But most people have no idea who the Diamondbacks are, mainly because they are so young. And this is what I admire so much about the Diamondbacks. They have young kids throughout their system, and they just said, forget it. We're bringing up our best young kids. We think they're ready, and we're going to throw them right in the middle of a pennant race and see what they're made of. And so far, all those kids are made of the right stuff.
Let's return to the American League, where the Los Angeles Angels of Greater Orange County and the John Wayne Airport have had a fantastic season. In relative anonymity, why aren't these guys the favorites?
Well, they play out west, and people just aren't paying attention to them, as it often happens with the West teams. But, you know, if you don't watch out for the Angels, they can really sneak up on you because their starting pitching and their bullpen is very, very good, and I would not want to see the Angels in the playoffs. However, a lot of us thought the Angels might try to make a splash at the trading deadline and go get another hitter because I believe they are clearly one hitter short. And the fact that they didn't do that makes me wonder, are they going to flame out in the playoffs like they've done a couple of times here lately? But the bottom line is they're a good club and they have good pitching and they're just one of many teams. When they make the playoffs, they're going to have a chance to go to the World Series.
The league's steroid investigation, headed by George Mitchell, is, of course, ongoing. The former U.S. senator has thus far met with only one active player, New York Yankee Jason Giambi. Even though the former MVP admitted that he had used steroids, Commissioner Bud Selig has decided not to punish Giambi. You think this will encourage more players to talk?
I don't think so, Bill. I mean, Giambi was in a lot of trouble. And his only way out of it was to cooperate with the Mitchell investigation. Otherwise, he would have been punished. And if he had been punished, that is, maybe suspended, the Players Association would have jumped in and we would have had a big fight on our hands. And Jason Giambi wanted no part of that. So he said, all right, I'll just get this over with, get off the hook here, and move ahead. But that's because he's talked before. Nobody else other than him has really talked about this. That's why they wanted him to cooperate. But all the other guys who are trying to hide something, I just don't see any way they'll say, look, I'd like to get this off my chest. Let me cooperate. Don't punish me, and then I'll be in the clear. I just don't see that happening, really, with anybody else.
The Barry Bonds quest for the home run record has finally come to its awkward conclusion. Tim, do you see the Mitchell investigation focusing its attention on the new home run king next?
I think so. I think the Giambi issue tried to lay the groundwork to get Barry Bonds to cooperate with the Mitchell investigation. Now, I don't think Barry Bonds will do it. If baseball tries to make him do it, I believe he will fight it, and if he fights it, I think he will win. And I just don't think baseball can win in something like this, and I see no reason why Barry Bonds would want to cooperate. So my guess is he's not going to have anything to do with it.
And speaking of home run kings,
two balls, no strikes on Roger Maris. Here's the windup. Fastball hits deep.
That was broadcaster Phil Rizzuto with a call of Roger Maris's 61st home run back in 1961. Rizzuto, who was the Yankee play-by-play man for over 40 years, died of pneumonia this week. Rizzuto was also a Hall of Fame shortstop and, of course, a key member of the Yankee dynasty of the 40s and 50s. How will you remember the man they called Scooter, Tim?
Well, I'll remember his smile, first off, because it was unmistakable, and I will remember his size. Bill, as you know, he is a little, little guy, and for people to have told him, including Casey Stengel, when he was 16 years old, Rizzuto, you got no chance. You should go home and pick up a shoeshine box, because that's what you're supposed to be doing. And Phil Rizzuto said, I want nothing to do with this, and not only went out and made a major league team, but as you said, he went to the Hall of Fame. He played on championship teams. He won an MVP one year. He almost won another MVP. I mean, this is a great American story that somebody of this stature decides that he's not taking no for an answer and goes out and gets it done. Extremely great career by Phil Rizzuto.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, thanks again.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Coors Field has been the home of the Colorado Rockies since 1995. It's been called a pitcher's purgatory, the place where earned run averages go to die, where light-hitting shortstops earn lucrative contracts and power hitters surprise even themselves. But times have changed in Colorado. Coors Field is not the power park that it once was, and there is one big reason for that. It's called the Humidor. Keith O'Brien has our story.
Batting practice at Coors Field has historically been something of a redundant activity. As far as pitchers were concerned, the games were like batting practice, what with the thin air and low humidity. But that began to change in 2002 when the Rockies began storing their baseballs in a temperature-controlled space known as the Humidor. Just don't call it that around the Rockies Vice President of Ballpark Operations, Kevin Kahn.
Formal name is the Environmental Chamber. Humidor was just kind of something that I'm not even sure who started that.
The name aside, here's how it works. The Humidor is a 9x9x7-foot box in the bowels of the stadium.
It's basically a space that we can control the temperature and the humidity so that we can keep the baseballs that are shipped here and kept here within the Major League Baseball specifications for weight and circumference.
The implication is that wasn't always happening before the Rockies started keeping their game balls in the humidor, where the temperature is always 70 degrees and the humidity is always 50%. Up until 2002, the Rockies stored their baseballs just like any other team, in a plain old room near the field. And what happened, says Kahn, was that the baseballs dried out in Colorado's low humidity. Pitchers were then forced to deal not only with the mile-high altitude, where the ball naturally travels farther, but with a dry, slippery baseball.
They're using the analogy of trying to throw a cue ball from pool, that it was just slick and they couldn't get a grip on the ball. And as a result, it was tougher to throw the curveballs, to throw things other than fastballs.
The results were somewhat predictable. According to the Elias Sports Bureau, in the Rockies' first 7 seasons at Coors, there were 57% more home runs and 65% more total runs in Rockies' home games than in the team's road games, by far the top percentages of any stadium in that time period. But since the introduction of the humidor, these numbers have begun to fall. Lately, Rockies' home games have produced just 28% more runs than Rockies' road games, and according to Elias statisticians, 3 parks have had a greater effect on home runs than Coors since 2002. U.S. Cellular Field in Chicago, Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia, and Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference.
Rockies slugger Todd Helton.
Just the feel of the ball is different, and it's probably for the best. We're not out there for 5 hours. Guys don't get worn down as quick. I think it gives us a better chance to win also. So it's made a big impact on us, and maybe for the better, hopefully.
In the pre-humidor days, and let's be clear, all the players call it the humidor, Helton says a guy could mishit a ball and still knock it out of the park. Now he says a guy can hit the ball as hard as he can to center field or the opposite way, and it still might not go out. Neither way is ideal, says Helton, and others have been even more critical. Last summer, former Rocky and current Arizona Diamondback Jeff Cirillo claimed that the baseballs at Coors Field seemed waterlogged. And on a visit to Coors earlier this year, Atlanta Braves pitcher John Smoltz also weighed in against the humidor.
My whole concern is who's controlling it.
Baseball's at its best, Smoltz says, when the game stays out of its own way and just lets the players play. A humidor complicates things. And he says he hasn't really noticed a difference. Even with the humidor, he hates playing at Coors.
The field is so big that there's so many hits that it's almost indefensible. My hat's off to those who have pitched shutouts here who have done great jobs, but for the most part, it's hard to get three outs.
Deep inside the Rocky Stadium, Kevin Kahn opens the door to the humidor and then steps inside.
It looks like a walk-in freezer.
That's basically what it is, and when we show people, they're a little underwhelmed. You know, use the analogy of seeing the Wizard in the Wizard of Oz, and you go behind the curtain, and it's like, oh, okay, that's it. I think they're expecting to see something other than what they see. It's a pretty simple concept and pretty simple space.
For these reasons, Kahn and the Rockies are tired of talking about the humidor. As they see it, they've done the best they can to make playing at Coors comparable to playing elsewhere.
To say that all of a sudden now, you know, it's all going to be 1-0 games, I mean, that's couldn't be further from the truth.
But Kahn says there's clearly been a difference. And in his most recent outing at Coors Field earlier this season, John Smoltz may have noticed a difference as well. In front of 28,000 fans, he pitched 7 innings of 2-run baseball with 8 strikeouts and just 1 walk and got the win. For only a game, I'm Keith O'Brien in Denver.
If you perchance have a predilection, a penchant, or even a passion for podcasts, please proceed to onlyagame.org and press podcast. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour. Some of our sports traditions are considered gifts to be passed from generation to generation, but commentator Alyssa Eli is fond of a recreational activity that hardly fosters a sense of intergenerational accord.
Life changes. I know this because the adult swim in our local pool has become a reliable pleasure. All through childhood, it was only a reliable scourge. The warning whistle blew for the first time at 4:55 p.m., At 4:59, it would blow again, more warningly. No one listened. A minute later, we were hauled out by lifeguards, gasping like fish on docks. Our parents paid annual dues for 15 minutes of pool time each night without interference. We resented every second. Children were supposed to clear the pool entirely, but we would sit on the concrete edges, toes dangling illegally in the water. We were little criminals, reminding the older generation that we intended to live on after they were gone. Grown-ups could rent the water, but we owned it. Pale fathers emerged from locker rooms and left their briefcases sunning by lounge chairs. Mothers would reach for their swim caps and pop their hair under flower petals. Two by two, they moved towards the deep end. The sedate heterosexuality of it always drove us mad. They never dived, those grown-ups. They lowered themselves inch by inch from ladders. Where there had been mayhem, there was a line of lap swimmers, bumper to polite bumper. Their joylessness defied the rules of our pool and also the rules of our life. We couldn't understand it. I understand it now. 4 decades later, I stop at the end of each length to count my pulse and worry about foot fungus. When the clock over the snack bar says only a minute is left in adult swim, the kids on deck can't stand it anymore. They start counting out loud. I remember how it was. It's New Year's Eve, the ball's dropping, and if grown-ups don't vacate the pool in 15, 10, 4, 2 seconds, they have no one to blame but themselves. We pull ourselves onto land in the nick of time. The ball hits the ground, a roar goes up, and dozens of little criminals charge the water. They're filled with ecstatic purpose. Adult swim is over. The joy is back. The pool is under proper ownership again. They plan never to grow old. No one ever does.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist in Massachusetts.
Don't you realize we're living to die? I'm happy to sigh in the good old bad old days. Taking the breaks. Making mistakes in the good old, bad old
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, half a marathon is better than none, and maybe better than a whole marathon, too. But first, for a discussion of the week's news, Charlie Pierce joins me by phone from Nashville. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Are you in Nashville to protest the possibility of the Predators moving to Kansas City or Ontario?
No. They're very alarmed about that, though, because their hockey team is very important to them here on Music Row.
This week, the NFL presented the steps that it will take to prevent concussions, or at least multiple concussions. Commissioner Roger Goodell announced that since the brain is, quote, unique and complex, he wants the league to manage concussions conservatively and put player safety over competitive concerns. How will things change?
Well, it depends. Is he actually going to do that, or is he going to put together a complex brain commission to study it over the next 3 years? I think there are certain technological improvements you can make. I think there are certain medical caution. I mean, you can actually have legitimate medical staffs on all the teams that don't allow people to do things that they shouldn't be doing with concussions. But to eliminate somehow, you know, concussions from the game of football is ridiculous, and he knows it.
Tim Donaghy pleaded guilty on Wednesday to two felony charges of engaging in wire fraud and transmitting betting information through interstate commerce. He'd previously acknowledged that he had bet on games that he had officiated. Do you think any other referees, team, or league officials or players were involved in Mr. Donaghy's schemes?
I don't have any idea, but they better hope there isn't, because it's just the only way this could get worse for the NBA is for there to be somebody else. And I maintain that the most horrible thing of all about this scandal, we may all owe Rasheed Wallace an apology. He may have been right all along.
Officials in Arizona informed the NBA this week that they may bring charges of their own against Tim Donaghy if it can be demonstrated that his activities befouled playoff games in Phoenix on April 29th and May 12th of this year. I gotta wonder whether law enforcement personnel in all the other NBA cities are looking at tape even as we speak.
Well, it depends if they've all got banners from their home team hanging in the squad room, which is what I suspect is the case with this Arizona bunch. The feds have him. Leave him alone. You lost. If you want to throw somebody in jail, Phoenix Sun fans wearing badges, throw David Stern in for suspending Amari Stoudemire.
In actual basketball news, Charlie, the Tournament of the Americas, which will help determine which teams go to the Beijing Olympics next summer, gets underway on Wednesday in Las Vegas. Will Carmelo Anthony, Chauncey Billups, LeBron James et al. Carry the U.S. to victory?
I think they'll be fine. I really do. They certainly are playing on their home court, and who knows? We get all those damn foreigners loose in Vegas, and who knows what'll happen.
The Oklahoma group that purchased the Seattle Supersonics wishes to move the franchise to Oklahoma City. But, surprise, the new owners may agree to leave the team where it is if Seattle builds a new arena. So, any words of advice for Seattle taxpayers?
Yes. Pick up your torches and your pitchforks and march down there and drive those greedy sons of guns out of town, you know, forthwith. You're being extorted. Don't be extorted. I'm sorry it cost you your basketball team. Wave goodbye.
Charlie, there's sad baseball news this week. Phil Rizzuto died of pneumonia at the age of 89. Have you happy memories of his signature calls during Yankee games?
I just remember that when the guys put together that book called Oh Holy Cow, where they sort of broke his calls up into poetry, he was such a mensch and went along with it so well and was so good-humored about it, it made me a fan of his forever.
Absolutely. Jason Giambi's reward for cooperating with George Mitchell's investigation of steroids in baseball was a free pass from Commissioner Selig. No punishments for Mr. Giambi. Are other players likely to ring up Mr. Mitchell now?
Well, I mean, it's a good thing to do if you want to maintain your lack of suspension from the major leagues. It's a bad thing to do if you want to stay out of the hoosegow. A lot of this stuff is still illegal. So I think that, you know, Jason Giambi has been cooperative with a number of investigations, and I think that had a lot to do with the free pass he got from Major League Ball.
Jose Offerman, on the other hand, is likely to encounter some severe disciplining that goes well beyond the confines of the ball yard. During a minor league game on Tuesday, Offerman, who's been playing for the Long Island Ducks, whacked two Bridgeport Bluefish players with a bat. Where do you go after you're banished from the Atlantic League?
I don't really know, because there's no such thing as like going to play baseball in Europe or something. The basketball players always have that scam. This was the worst thing I've seen with a baseball player and a bat. You know, it harkens back to Juan Marichal and Bert Campanera, are the only two that I can think of. Yeah, Robert De Niro in The Untouchables.
It was learned yesterday that former NHL player and assistant coach Rick Tocchet will not serve jail time despite his participation in an illegal New Jersey sports gambling ring. He could have received 5 years of prison time. He'll serve 2 years probation instead. So, punishment fit the crime in this case?
It seems to fit the crime as far as the feds are concerned. It will be very interesting to see if Rick Tocchet ever has a career in the National Hockey League again.
Chinese officials have denied that 1.5 million people will have been displaced by the time Beijing is finished building Olympic venues. These officials also say that, quote, most people being relocated are satisfied. So, no worries there, right?
It's amazing how happy you can be in an authoritarian state, isn't it? You did notice, of course, this week that they decided they wanted to do something about the smog, so they just banned cars.
Yeah.
This is the kind of place that ought to always have the Olympics.
And finally, Charlie, in Wales, Gil McKenzie, Ray McKenzie, and their 14-year-old son, Sam McKenzie, all recently shot holes in one within a 3-day period. And William Hill, the famous bookie joint in London, has said that the odds against that were 15 million to one. How do you figure the odds on three people in the same family all shooting a hole-in-one during a 3-day period?
I think there's a British bookmaker who could come up with the odds on three people from the same family shooting holes-in-ones on Neptune. It's just what they do.
And they would take your bet, too.
They would. And I would probably bet on it.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and the odds are that he will join me next week, just as he has this week. Thank you very much, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. Born for the PGA. He was born for the PGA. Born for the PGA. He's the number one golfer in the PGA.
Earlier this month, about 10,000 runners lined up in Central Park for the New York City Half Marathon. Among them was international running superstar Haile Gebrselassie, who went on to win the race in 59 minutes, 24 seconds. Just over 9,900 runners finished behind Mr. Gebrselassie, including only a game's Karen Given, who came back without a trophy but with this story.
All right, welcome everyone to Corey's 4.13-mile run. We have a lot of new people tonight, so welcome.
It's 4 days before the New York City Half Marathon, and I'm waiting on a busy street for the start of the Somerville Roadrunners weekly race. After 12 weeks of training, I'm here to get some last-minute advice from the SRR's resident half marathon expert, John O'Malley. He's run races all over the Northeast and in places like Florida, Virginia, Wisconsin, California, and Oregon. Earlier this year, he won the Antarctica Half Marathon. Along with a friend, he's trying to join the Seven Continents Club. For most people, that's what it's called when you run a marathon on every continent. O'Malley has put his own spin on it.
I do the half because you have to train for it. It's a very tough race. You have to put a good 8 to 12 week effort into training for this if you want to be fairly serious at it. And on top of that, I don't want to do a full marathon. The human body is only meant to do about 20 miles in the first place, so let's just add another 10K on. Doesn't make sense to me. And your body starts breaking down, and the fact that people collapse after these things doesn't make it all that enthusiastic for me to go for one.
O'Malley's not the only one who thinks the half marathon is the perfect race distance. Back in the spring, I spoke with Mary Wittenberg, the president and CEO of the New York Roadrunners. Wittenberg's one of running's most earnest promoters. Even a relatively unathletic reporter like me can't escape her enthusiasm. You should run the half, she said to me. The half is going to be the next big thing. In fact, I'm going to start an international campaign to rename the half marathon, because 13.1 miles, that's a whole race.
Oh, good luck to you. Here's Karen Given from Only a Game, and she's running her first half marathon on Sunday?
Sunday,
so good luck to her.
So here I am, getting cheered on by a running club filled with people who have plenty of respect for the half marathon. But to non-runners, I keep having to say things like, I'm just running a half, and I'm only running 13.1 miles. It's getting pretty annoying. But what should the race be called? Maybe John O'Malley, the half marathon expert, will have an idea.
That's a good question. I've always thought about what it should be called, because half marathon, like you said, it's a little demeaning, let's face it. 13 plus miles of fun? I don't know. I'd have to think about that one.
On your mark, get set, go Yankees!
As the Somerville Roadrunners leave for their weekly run up Winter Hill, I'm left wondering, what would be a better name for the half? Maybe there's something in the legend of how the marathon got its name. The story goes like this. In 490 BC, a soldier named Pheidippides ran from the battlefield at Marathon to the city of Athens. He arrived, announced that the Athenians had won the battle, and promptly died. Could we name the half after the geographical halfway point on that route? The map points me to a town called Pakermi, a pretty cool name, but it also shows me a problem. The distance between Marathon and Athens is only 24 miles, more than 2 miles short of the standard marathon distance. There's got to be something off about this legend. I bet Peter Lovesey, member of the Society of Olympic Historians, knows the halfway point of Pheidippides' journey.
I think the distance that Pheidippides ran is sort of much disputed anyway. Some people think he might have run about 180 miles, in fact. So I think it's difficult to be precise about that one.
As Lovesey explains, the first Olympic marathon in 1896 measured 24 miles from the modern city of Marathon to Athens, Greece. Over the next few years, marathons were held at all sorts of distances, from as little as 20 miles to upwards of 26. Then, organizers began laying out the course for the 1908 London Marathon.
From Windsor Castle to the White City Stadium in London, the new stadium that had been built specially for the Games. It was a distance of around about 26 miles. The stadium was a big one. There was a sort of three laps to the mile, and it was decided that they should run about two-thirds of the way round and finish in front of the Royal Box.
Okay, well, what was the halfway point in that race? Could that be a good name?
Oh, goodness me. That's some little village out in the sticks. I don't know whether that would be a very great idea, really. I can't think that that it would help us very much. Perhaps you should name it after a notable half-marathon runner rather than naming it after a little village on the route of the 1908 marathon, although it is an idea.
Well, that's tough, because the half marathon isn't run in the Olympics, so legendary half marathon runners are hard to come by. But regardless of the name, more and more people are running half marathons, at least according to David Willey, editor-in-chief of Runner's World magazine.
Well, it's by far the fastest growing race distance there is in all of racing right now. It's growing faster than marathons. It's growing faster than 5Ks, because it's the perfect balance of being long enough that you do have to train for it, and with training comes commitment, and with commitment comes all that payoff, but short enough so that it doesn't beat you up. You know, it really is kind of the perfect hybrid.
Many of the big races are now having to cap their entries, and some have even instituted a lottery system to decide who gets in. But while nearly 200,000 more people ran half marathons last year than marathons, the longer distance still gets all the glory.
Good luck tomorrow.
All right, thank you.
It's less than 24 hours before the race, and I'm starting to get more than a little scared. Luckily, Mary Wittenberg, the woman who started this whole thing, is on hand to help me out.
You will have so much fun tomorrow. You'll be with 10,000 runners from around the world. There's such wonderful, quiet serenity in Central Park. And then you get out to the blast of the New York City streets, and you just have a great time running through Times Square and then downtown to Lady Liberty. After you finish this race tomorrow, go tell some people you ran a 13.1-mile race, and they'll be in awe.
Wittenberg says her staff thinks she's crazy for wanting to change the name of the half marathon. But like me, she can't get the idea out of her head. 590,000 people ran half marathons in the U.S. last year, and all of them were saddled with the word half in front of their accomplishment.
I've been thinking about it since that conversation, continue to think about it. We really need to come up with another name. It just doesn't do it justice. As I keep saying, there's nothing half about this event except for the name. You know, it's a big time event, it's a big distance, and it's going to be a big celebration, and you know, we need a better name to do it justice.
Wittenberg tells me that my mantra should be, I can do it, I can do it. But the next morning, faced with the pre-race jitters, I'm having a little trouble with that concept. Maybe my iPod can help. Okay, I know it's cheesy, but when faced with double-digit miles in front of you, a disco diva really can make you feel better. I'm lined up at the back of the pack because I'm slow. But as we go past the hills in Central Park, I'm reminded that I'm also strong. Running into Times Square, which feels like it's been closed just for me, I can't shake the feeling that I can do this. And before I know it, I realize I almost have.
All right, runners, if you can hear my voice once again, you are almost there. You've almost done it. There it is, the promised land, the finish line of the 2007 New York City Half Marathon.
I sprint across the timing strip, arms held high. It's a feeling that's hard to describe, and as David Willey suggested earlier, it's one you're only likely to get after spending 12 weeks training for something you never thought was possible. I've lost count of the number of people who've asked me when I plan to run a full marathon. They seem to think my life won't be complete until I take on that challenge. But my favorite post-race kudos came from my friend and fellow half-marathoner, Anne. Her email simply said, "Congratulations, you finished a whole race." For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in New York.
I'm only halfway to paradise. Look so near, yet so far away.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We'd like to offer a fond end of the summer send-off to our intern, Ben Singer, who returned to Brown University despite the allure of slightly more dangerous work with the Navy SEALs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen's half-marathon photo gallery in its entirety, my Beckham pictures from Foxborough, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Society of Olympic Historians member Peter Lovesey, who offers an alternative name for the half marathon.
Yes, perhaps you should just call it a mara. Yes, or a form, yes.
I just prefer to call it yet another road race that I will never attempt to run. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Don't leave me halfway to paradise. So near, yet so far away.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR.